Thank you. So the next segment of the session, the last but final one, is clinical epidemiology in the era of big data. My name is Madhu Pai. I'm a professor of epidemiology and director of global health programs. And it's a pleasure for me to introduce my colleague, Dr. Sami Swisa, who needs very little introduction in this department. Sami is a James McGill professor and a director of Center for ClinEpi at Lady Davis Institute and a professor in our Epi Biostats department. He heads the Canadian Network for Observational Drug Effect Studies called CNODES and the McGill Pharmaco-Epi Research Unit, and a founding director of Quebec's research network on medication use funded by the FRQS. In order to give him more time, I'm not going to read through his entire bio, but I think it'll be enough to say that few people have done as much as Sami and his team to put McGill on the world's map as far as pharmacoepi is concerned. An amazing amount of work for many, many years and makes McGill a very desirable place to come and study pharmacoepi. And you will see this in our student population. A good number of our MSc and PhD students do their thesis research in pharmacoepi. It has been really fun for me to watch how well they work together. I'm talking about students. How collaborative they are, Epi Biostats, all working on pharmacoepi, how they stimulate and support each other. That kind of a wonderful research concentration within our department is quite exceptional. And they stimulate each other with innovations in biostats that informs drug safety work. So there's an applied component, but there's also a very strong methodological component. So Sami is going to talk to us about trials and tribulations in the area of pharmacoepi.
Thank you very much, Madhu. So 25 years of pharmacoepidemiology in 25 minutes, and I will hold to my time. So in fact, the three eras of pharmacoepidemiology at McGill. The first one I call the daring 90s. It all started with this study published in The Lancet in 1989. It was a case control study that showed that a drug used to treat asthma was in fact perhaps causing deaths from asthma. So the paradox that the drug is supposed to treat the disease is in fact harming patients with that disease. And this study used a case control design that respirologists had never heard about, especially in the context of using the association between a drug and an outcome. The culprit, or the potential culprit, was this bronchodilator, Berotec or Fenotrol, and the association, the data showed that the risk was about 50% higher, the risk of mortality from asthma was 50% higher in the patients that were using this drug. And that's where pharmacoepidemiology at McGill started. The response, in fact, well, before I talk about the response, the drugs that were used to treat asthma at the time and still being used right now are made up of two classes. The bronchodilators that allow to open up the airways and treat the symptoms of asthma, and the inhaled corticosteroids, which are anti-inflammatory and tackle the inflammation in the airways to more long-term treatment of the disease, of the condition. So the two are necessary in the treatment of asthma. And so the initiation of pharmacoepidemiology at McGill, I have to say, comes from this study, the Saskatchewan asthma study, which identified 12,000 patients with asthma from the province of Saskatchewan. Why Saskatchewan? Because Saskatchewan I don't see the slides here, so I have to turn and perhaps give my back to the people on the left. Sorry about that. So Professor Spitzer's name was mentioned before. He was a chairman of the department, and he was the leader of this initial study. And I'd like to I think this study is really a tribute to his initiative, and Professor Spitzer passed away a few years ago, but he was certainly the lead in pharmacoepidemiology at McGill. So why Saskatchewan? Because Saskatchewan, thanks to our universal healthcare insurance system, allowed for the collection of data computerized on medications, diagnoses, hospitalizations, mortality, etc., and all this was linked, so it was easy to go in there and access these data. The result was a study, an observational study that we published in 1992 that looked at this association, and the study found some interesting results. It showed that there was a wide range of utilization of these medications, these bronchodilators, in the population in Saskatchewan. In fact, there were two populations. There was the populations that were using the medication as recommended, so in essence, two bronchodilators per month, which is the maximal recommended dose. But there is this other population within the asthma patients who were using much more than the recommended dose, and these were the patients who were also who had much higher rate of asthma mortality. So I think this study opened up many questions about the usage or the misuse of these medications, but also that some of these patients may not have been treated properly, and that brought us to the then posed the question of whether these patients were actually perhaps not using properly the other medication which treats the underlying condition, namely the anti-inflammatory drugs, these inhaled corticosteroids. And this was the result of a second study on a second cohort of patients with asthma from Saskatchewan, where we looked at low-dose inhaled corticosteroids associated with asthma mortality in that same population, expanded and updated cohort from this database. We found that basically patients who were not using these medications had higher rates of asthma mortality, whereas patients who were using them regularly had a much lower incidence of asthma mortality. So in essence, that initial study came up with had a major impact on the treatment of asthma around the world. What it found is that bronchodilators were overused and that inhaled corticosteroids were underused. Now, this, of course, was in Saskatchewan, but respirologists agreed that this was the case around the world. And the result of the study was that, in essence, bronchodilator use should be reduced and that inhaled corticosteroid use should be increased to manage asthma properly and to reduce asthma mortality. What is the impact of this studies on asthma around the world? Well, we have seen this in four countries. So four countries have looked at their data and correlated asthma mortality over time with inhaled corticosteroid use, and all of them have found that with increasing use of inhaled corticosteroids over time, there's this constant pattern of decrease in asthma mortality, and this is true in all countries where this was looked at. And currently, asthma mortality is so rare that you cannot conduct randomized controlled trials on the outcome of asthma death because it is managed properly. Now we move to the second era in pharmacoepidemiology at McGill, and I call them the Roaring 2000s. Why the Roaring 2000s? Because we now have, in 2000, we started to get quicker and better access to the data that we need for pharmacoepidemiology purposes. So one of them is the CPRD, which is a United Kingdom Clinical Practice Research Data Link, which is available freely to anyone around the world, of course, if they pay a certain amount of money to obtain it. But it's a very nice network, over 1,000 GPs, 10 million patients, data from 1990 up to today, data on diagnoses, lab tests, prescriptions, hospitalizations, etc. So lots of data available, and those data are sitting in a computer in London, and you can actually today, and this is why I call them the Roaring 2000s, you can download the data directly through an internet connection into our center, which is at the Jewish General Hospital. So this is a major step in the advancement of pharmacoepidemiology today, the access of data, the better access to data that are necessary to conduct these kind of studies. And I will give you a couple of examples during these 2000s, that examples of studies that McGill was involved in. First is the painkiller Vioxx. You may have heard of Vioxx. In fact, Vioxx was one of these second generation NSAIDs, which was developed specifically to avoid gastrointestinal problems of the older NSAIDs. And it was a very popular drug, but it was pulled from the market in 2004 because it was causing some cardiac events and it was associated with acute myocardial infarction. And the question we were posing is whether the next generation of Vioxxes, so the next generation of COX-2 inhibitors, may also have the same properties because they are of a similar class, except they are of a newer generation. So our Coxia and Bextra are of these new generations. And we were able to look at this because there are populations not in Canada where these drugs were already on the market. And again, if you have access to those data, you're able to look at these effects. And we looked at cardiovascular events. We looked at stroke specifically as well. Again, very quickly with data that were available in the United Kingdom where the drugs had been available already for a few years. And we found that in both instances, valdecoxib was associated, basically, our Bextra and our Coxia were associated with increased risks of acute MI and of stroke compared to non-use of these medications. So they were also associated with these elevated risks, just like the first generations of the new NSAIDs. As a result of this, Pfizer had to withdraw valdecoxib from the market here in Canada, and I think this is the kind of research we want to do if we identify safety problems with certain drugs. We don't make the decision, we provide the data, but companies will do this kind of withdrawing from the market. Interestingly, our Coxia was not available on the market in Canada and the U.S., and perhaps due to some of these studies, our Coxia was not approved for marketing in the United States. Examples with Parkinson's disease medications, there is something that, especially when we are not specialists in pharmacology, we kind of tend to think that drugs of the same class have exactly the same effect. So these are all dopamine agonists, and they're all different brands, different chemical structures, but they're all called dopamine agonists, and we have a tendency to believe that they will then have all the same effects. But I learned from my pharmacology students who come to learn about epidemiology that they may have an effect on dopamine, but they may have effects on other pathways in a very different way. And an example is two of these here, cabergoline and pergolide, seem to be affecting the heart receptors in a very specific way that other dopamine agonists do not. And this is what the pharmacologist identified. And case reports were published that perhaps patients using these drugs had these unusual cases of valvular regurgitation. So we looked at this question using, again, the CPRD and identified a cohort of patients with Parkinson's disease looking at valvular regurgitation cases in there. And we found, indeed, what the case reports were suggesting, that these two agents, cabergoline and pergolide, were associated with very high increased risk of valvular regurgitations, where the other dopamine agonists were not. So interestingly enough, understanding the pharmacology can help in identifying the safety of certain types of medications. And indeed, as a result of this, the study very rapidly, the FDA in this case actually pulled Permax, pergolide, from the market. Cabergoline was not available in the market in the U.S., so it was a non-issue with respect to that drug. Pharmacoepidemiology methods, I think we've done an outstanding work in terms of method during the 2000s, and I'm just giving here an overview of some of the papers. So Mikhail Abramovich, for example, has been working on how to measure exposure and how to associate that with outcomes in his, in various spline models. work on confounding, adjustment for confounding, propensity scores, instrumental variables. I think we're really state of the art in terms of this. I can mention Robert Platt. I can mention Jim Hanley, who doesn't call himself a pharmacoepidemiologist. He's basically a global statistician, global epidemiologist. He touches every field, and he also has worked on case-based methods that are applicable to pharmacoepidemiology. I cannot skip this talk without talking about time-related biases, and I think it's important. It's important also because Tom Lewis is here and Stan Shapiro are here, and where they were talking, I mean, Stan perfectly talked about when to do a trial. So this trial was published just a few months ago, a year ago perhaps, in the New England Journal. Simvastatin, a statin used for the treatment of cholesterol, high cholesterol, used in the prevention of exacerbations in moderate to severe COPD. And you look at this title and you say, excuse me, what's going on here? One is treating cholesterol. The other one is a lung disease that's basically cigarette tobacco associated. Why would one prevent exacerbations of the other? What does this have to do with one another? Well, in fact, if you simply read the introduction to the paper, and you will see that retrospective studies have shown that statins decrease the rate and severity of exacerbations, the rate of hospitalization, and mortality in chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. This is the basis for the study. The basis for the study is that there have been observational studies that have shown these spectacular effects of statins in COPD. And in fact, this is a kind of meta-analysis of these observational studies. And you see, the one thing that you see is that all of the black squares are to the left of the line one. Line one is rate ratio of one. So everything to the left means protective. And you get spectacular effects on all-cause mortality with statin use, on COPD mortality, on COPD hospitalization, exacerbations, intubations as well. So if you're taking statins, you have 90% fewer intubations due to COPD exacerbations than if you're not on statins. So these are the basis for running this controlled trial, and I think we can have a lot of discussion on the ethics of this. But in fact, in terms of the ethics, years before, simply by chance, I had done a review of some of these studies that were coming out in the literature looking at the effect of cardiovascular drug therapies in COPD. And I'm just going to go directly to the conclusions, where I said the reports of remarkable statin effectiveness in reducing all-cause mortality in COPD are in fact the result of immortal time bias and immeasurable time bias. All the studies that you have seen here basically were not measuring exposure properly, and they were all biasing results to the left. And as a last sentence, careful analysis of observational study methods and appropriate adjustment of study findings to eliminate bias can help prevent the conduct of frivolous controlled trials. And this was written before the trials was initiated, but despite that, the introduction to the randomized trial it basically said there are some very good evidence from observational studies. And not surprisingly, the results of the randomized control trial show that statin use has absolutely zero effect on the time to a first exacerbation, and I can guarantee you that had the trial been larger, it would have zero effect on all-cause mortality as well. And in fact, this was published. Jeff Drazen, the editor of the New England Journal, wanted absolutely to have this figure to explain the issue of immortal time bias and how the exposure is misclassified and therefore leads to this apparent increased survival in patients who are exposed but incorrectly analyzed. The reason I'm talking about this is there's currently a randomized control trial of, again, two things that have absolutely no relationship. Metformin is a drug used in first-line treatment of type 2 diabetes and breast cancer. So you would say, what would one have to do with the other? Of course, in cancer, we're always looking for drugs that can improve survival or reduce the rate of recurrence. And this is a very large trial. 3,600 women have been enrolled since July 2010 in this trial. where half are receiving metformin, the other half is receiving placebo, in addition to the usual treatment for early stage breast cancer. And the basis for this study is, again, observational studies. And we actually looked at these observational studies to say, where is this coming from? Why is this trial being conducted? And not surprisingly, a very large number of them, I believe 19 of these studies, all have immortal time bias. So these are studies, when we talk about publication bias, journals want to publish good news papers. And these studies all give you good news paper. Basically, they give you good news results. 50% reduction in the incidence of lung cancer, 80% reduction in the incidence of liver cancer. These are all good news, and journals want to publish these good news papers, except that they are unfortunately incorrect. Let's move now to the soaring 2010s. I'm going to be on time. So what's new in 2010, and I'm calling them the soaring 2010s, because now we've moved up one level again. So from access to data, now we are moving to CNODES, which is access to many databases at the same time, and access to many resources, many scientists working together on issues of drug safety. And this is finally, after 25 years of lobbying, the government of Canada has finally realized that one of their missions is public health in terms of medication use. So the safety of medication should not be delegated to a pharmaceutical industry that has certain interests here, but that the government and Health Canada should be involved in research on issues of drug safety. And in fact, if you look at Canadian pharmacoepidemiology, the example I showed you with Saskatchewan, in fact, is true for every province. Every province has their own twist to the healthcare insurance program, twist to the databases, and all of them have actually conducted studies in pharmacoepidemiology. In fact, if you look at publications from Manitoba, British Columbia, Nova Scotia, Ontario has been a very big player here, Quebec, besides Saskatchewan, they've all played a role in pharmacoepidemiology, but individually. And we may ask the question, why CNODES? Why a network? Well, in fact, an example, we're going back to the example of Vioxx. So the example of Vioxx is a perfect example of why we would need a network to answer these questions. These are the observational studies that have looked at this question of whether Vioxx increases the risk of cardiovascular events. And the three studies that I'm showing here are actually three studies that had been conducted and published before the drug was taken off the market. And the three studies had actually different results. One said there is no increased risk. Another said there is maybe an increased risk. But again, you had all of this discrepancy. Different methods were used. Some of them had immortal time bias, by the way, and other biases as well. But clearly, the methodology was not the strongest and best methodology available. In Canada, three studies had been conducted on Vioxx. The first one from Ontario in 2003. The second in Quebec, 2005. This is the date of publication. And the last one in 2009 from Saskatchewan, data from Saskatchewan. So what does CNODES want? CNODE would really like to have these studies conducted simultaneously, conducted early, and with the strongest available methodology to be most confident about the results of this study. And that's what CNODES is all about, is to do it now, to do it quickly, and to do it well. And also, why not British Columbia, why not Alberta, Manitoba, and Nova Scotia to be added to this pool of studies to get more accurate results. So CNODES, I think we can draw the map of Canada in this way with CNODES, as opposed to just the geography. We could add some estimates of effects, and then our CNODES effect would be somewhere in the Atlantic. We could put it in the Pacific also, but somewhere we could have our overall CNODES effect that combines the results from data from different provinces. So CNodes has a very extensive structure. It basically pays for the infrastructure. But I would like to point out that the pillars of CNodes are the four teams, which is methods. So we are very eager to develop new and better methods in pharmacoepidemiology. Databases, training. We will retire by a certain time point. We will retire, and we need to train the next generation who will take over CNodes. And knowledge translation. How do we explain this to the players, to the healthcare givers, and to the public? So the challenges in CNodes are very simple. Today, we don't have relative risks of 5 or 10 anymore. This doesn't exist. We're looking at small effects. We need large sample sizes. We absolutely need computerized databases. We can't have the answer in 10 years. We need to have the answer yesterday. And the results have to be consistent. So we need strong methodology to be sure that the results are consistent across different centers. And we have automatic replication by this methodology as well. And we want, as we said, we want rapid answers. So I'll give you a very quick example. Our first study, high-dose statins and the risk of acute kidney injury. And this is how this comes about. You have a large trial on statins that shows that there is a benefit with the primary cardiovascular endpoint, but there is possibly an effect on something called renal disorders in terms of the reported adverse events. And it's not statistically significant, but it's a small effect, but it may be important, and we want to know more about it. So does treatment with high-potency statins increase the risk of serious acute kidney injury? And this is something that we conducted, our first CNodes study published in the BMJ a couple of years ago. Now, typically, we have 9 cohorts of patients. We don't have one. We have 9 cohorts, one from each of the centers. This resulted in over 2 million patients treated with statins, and one-third of them, they were the ones that we were interested in, were the ones starting on high-dose statins. And during follow-up, 24,000 patients were hospitalized for acute kidney injury. This is a severe form of acute kidney injury that the patient that requires hospitalizations. And the result is meta-analysis. It's a meta-analysis of the different studies. We see that despite common protocols, there are still variations between provinces. But at the end of the day, the result shows this small increased risk, a 34% increase in the risk of acute kidney injury with high-dose statin use. Right now we have many studies that we've looked at proton pump inhibitors, we looked at antipsychotic drugs, and we're looking at a variety of different medications still now. I think that one aspect that I'm most proud of is the team that Robert Platt is heading, which is the CNodes methods team, and the work that they've been doing now. I think right now they have something like 19 papers in the oven that are cooking. The 3 or 4 of them are published here, but many of them are being either submitted for publication or have been submitted for publication, and they are improving methods of how we do pharmacoepidemiology with computerized databases. So where are we 25 years later here in pharmacoepidemiology at McGill? Just a few months ago, the Boehringer Foundation gave a gift to our dean, David Edelman, of $3 million for an endowed chair in pharmacoepidemiology. So the name is getting some recognition, and the academic endeavor of pharmacoepidemiology is also receiving some recognition. And I'm proud to say that McGill was the school that was chosen for this very specific chair. So where will we be in 25 years? I don't know, but Stan may help and tell me. Thank you very much.
It's really a comment, and it's triggered by your example with the statins and the COPD, and it really I think that we underestimate the impact and importance of good methodologic thinking, and that without it on a team, it's basically unethical. and that we need to push even harder to make sure what I call level zero design, that teams that are conducting and analyzing studies, especially retrospective where the data are easily available, that the team has the right skill sets on it. And I'll close by saying the example and the immortal bias is just one example of what is the overarching important thing in statistical thinking and in statistical practice. If you had to pick one item, I wouldn't pick Bayes. I'd pick the importance of the sampling plan, and that we should be constantly looking for that and at least understanding, for example, immortal bias is indeed a sampling plan issue, as almost everything that really has high leverage is. And my question is, agree?
I cannot agree more.
Thank you very much, Sammy. This was very interesting. Just wondered if you ever thought of adding American quote-unquote provinces to this, such as Kaiser Permanente or other accountable care organizations which also have linked databases. So just a question, why not go beyond the border?
So the Americans don't know it yet, but we have been infiltrating the MarketScan database, and we have used, in fact, MarketScan, which is a U.S.-based database, for some of our studies. But we are collaborating, in fact, at ISPE this summer in Boston. We will have a symposium on network of networks. There is the Mini Sentinel Network in the U.S., FDA-funded, similar to what CNODES is doing here, different methodology. There is also the Aspen Network in Asia, and the Protect Network in Europe. They are similar to what we are doing. I'm proud to say that we were the first to publish studies out of this. The other networks are still learning how to do this. But we will have a network of networks symposium where we will talk about the methodological challenges of the different networks and future collaborations between the different networks and countries.
So the challenges that pharmacoepi faces are immense, and this was brought home to me about 10-15 years ago. I was working in a rural hospital in India where they walk in with the snake bite with the snake in hand, and they say, "This is the snake that bit me," and huge number of deaths due to snake bites because it was a rural area in India. And so somebody did an analysis of mortality due to snake bites, and lo and behold, highest mortality is those who got the highest amount of anti-snake venom. Right? And so you know how intractable the confounding by indication problem in these areas is. So I'm really happy I'm not doing pharmacoepi. That much I can tell you. You can tear your hair out trying to even understand the confounding structures. So any questions or comments from our students who are always dealing with immortal time bias? Any questions or comments from our students? Anybody else has a question? Yes.
This is really a comment for our students, which is, I think, the three...
It's a comment for our students, and I had mentioned this to Tom Lewis after his talk and Stan's talk, and now I'm going to add Sammy's to the pile, that really, and this comes back to what Tom said yesterday about the bootstrap, these are three areas where even if you're working in global health or social epidemiology or anything, any of the areas that we work in, understanding and making sure you know the principles that Tom talked about sampling, that Stan talked about clinical trials and equipoise and decisions and etiologic decisions and pragmatic versus explanatory research, and Sammy's talk and Sammy's points about immortal time and confounding and yours about confounding by indication. These are sort of three foundational things where if you get the principles from those three things, you're going to be a much better epidemiologist across the board. So I'm glad to see lots of our students here. I'm glad to see lots of our students listening. And I think everybody needs to try to make those connections between what seem like very disparate areas of research, but really are all working on the same principles.
Anyone else have a final comment?
Yes.
Robin.
Yeah, so I just want to say that for those of us who worked on trying to create the funding behind what ultimately became DSEN and then CNODES, how immensely proud I am of this department, of you, Sammy, and what you've produced, because it was all well and good to finally convince Health Canada to dish up some money, but really, you've really delivered on the promise, and so I'm really immensely thrilled, actually. So an idea. So one thing that's interesting in Canada is that we have these 13 health systems. No one really knows that, but we do. And each of those health systems actually makes different decisions about what drugs they put in their formulary, which is actually good news, because then the drug is not inaccessible, it becomes relatively inaccessible to the average citizen in different provinces. The other thing we have as an asset is that we have now population-based drug information systems that are for all drugs, all people. And so Canada now has two incredibly interesting assets, these natural experiments and what drugs are going to be covered, that will allow you, I think, probably to study the same individuals, but those that have access to drugs versus not, and complete information on what drugs are dispensed to the entire population. So what are your ideas about how you could use that? What are the opportunities there, and what should we be doing, I mean, to try to facilitate that happening?
The toughest question. I think we still don't know yet. We still don't have these mechanisms in place for the data availability. We've been working primarily with the claims data. We attempted to obtain data from the private insurers. I know that Lucie has been working extensively on this. So I think we're not there yet, but we'd love to be there. And when we are there, I think it will be a great opportunity not only to study drug safety, but to study policies, as you have done, by the way, with benzodiazepines back in the 1997s, to study new policies that are put in place in different provinces or in the country regarding different drugs. So it will be, I think, a great opportunity. We have set up the basic infrastructure for CNODES. I think we've accomplished quite a bit in the first 4 years, but we are certainly not going to remain there. The idea is to always improve and look at new questions that will benefit the public. So we are not going to remain where we are. We are going to look at different methodologies, different sources of data, and connections with the world as well to answer questions for public health. And we'll consult you as well.
Thanks, Sammy.
Thank you. Hi, Sammy. Great talk. My name is Ken Johnson. I am a graduate from here, did a pharmacoepidemiology PhD here a long time ago with Saskatchewan Data. But my question is on quite a different realm. I'm very concerned about the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership, and I know part of that, the agreement, is about drugs and patents and such, and I was wondering if you just had any commentary on that as to the potential impact, because I'm very concerned that that agreement could undermine a tremendous amount of the research that gets done epidemiologically across the board, because it starts to lose, it potentially impacts on government's ability to make regulation around drugs, around environment, etc. Anyway, I wondered if you had any comment on that.
I cannot say anything about policy or regulatory issues with respect to that.
And I can say I think everyone in the room should be concerned and know more, as much as possible about it, because it potentially being an agreement basically created in the dark by multinationals and their interests, it could impact all of our ability to the evidence to impact on public health.
Thank you. Thank you, Simon.